Rock and roll.
All right. Hi, I'm Meg. I'm a food and sugar addict from Minnesota. Well, we just missed the best part. Anyway, I'm here to tell my story and hope that I am one person in a sea of all of us here will offer you some new thought, new way. I think the theme for this is beautiful. 12 Steps, a Pathway to Spiritual Awakening. I'm a former teacher, so Rick was so kind, I mailed 3 boxes of stuff. So tomorrow we're going to do some experiential stuff. Now, it's not going to be woo-woo and all that, but it will be a little different. I'm not going to do the traditional, here are the 12 steps, and then we're going to write and so on. We're going to do some different things, just because I'm sure a lot of you have. But first I'd like to say hello to those of you who've been here a year or less. Can you just wave your hands at me? Okay, thank you. You're brand new. Thank you. I would like to know those people. You don't have to raise your hands unless you want to, if you have experienced or experiencing relapse. Okay? All right, welcome. Thank you. How about those of you who have been abstinent and worked in a good solid program one day at a time? Okay. And how many of you are in there in between and you're just working on figuring it all out? My first memory, I always thought I was about 2. I found out I was 11 months old. I was sitting on my dad's shoulders, and what I remember, I was at a house. There was a formal dining table. It was a kitchen, had a black and white floor, but I remember there was a color TV. That was what was different. All right, I'm 63. And so this is 1959, and so color TV was new. And I remember seeing Huckleberry Hound, so those of you who are kind of my age will get that, and Huckleberry Hound was blue. But that was not the star event that I was waiting for. I knew I was going to get a treat because I was at someone else's house. That's all I could think about. And here, 63, well, I'm going to be 64 in a couple weeks, 63 years later, I can remember that as if it were yesterday. When I was 4 years old, my mom, well, you could say asleep, some people would say passed out, on the couch, and I had been ill, I had a fever. Well, they had orange baby aspirin then, and it was kind of busy. And so I waited till she was asleep, and I climbed up on the stove because it was in the shelf up tall. And we had the kind of stove where it had burners on one side and flat on the other, so it was very quiet. And I got up there, and I unscrewed the lid because this is before child protection and all that. And I proceeded to eat them. They were lovely, fizzy, warm, orange. Then when I was finished, I knew I had to wake her up because I just ate medicine. So she took me to the doctor and said a few choice words and had no money. We had to take a cab. She had no money. And she had to get the neighbor lady from downstairs to watch my sister because she was 2 at the time. And I had to take Ipecac and then, you know, kind of hooked it all up. But I knew at that time it was medicine. I knew it was wrong. So there's premeditated food use. Then when I was 5, I wanted to eat a bag of sugar. Well, I wanted one thing, right? And I kept pestering. We were driving to the beach. Well, sandbar. That's what they have in Dubuque, Iowa. Anyway, I kept pestering. Can I have one? And, of course, I'm in the back seat with a brand new bag. So I rip open the bag. It's amazing how you could do. I probably gnawed it open. And I proceeded to eat the whole. Well, then I asked for 2. And then I think I got the head slap or whatever. And then I proceeded to eat the whole bag. And didn't feel so well and didn't eat that particular item for a long time. And then tried it again later on. Because, you know, this time it might be different. Then when I was 12, you know, these are just some of the big events. My parents, you know, my parents were teachers, and so it's workshop week, and they bought a big, you know, birthday celebration deal, but they bought the full size. And it technically serves 96 people. in 1-inch squares. Now, I don't know who eats 1-inch squares. Well, I do, one at a time. So there was about half of that left. My parents were at school, of course, and my sister brought in the neighbors, and they were eating my crack. So I almost forked them all to death, shoved them out of the house, locked the door, and consumed the other half, and still ate dinner. And I was just your average Bohemian Irish German kid. You know, I didn't start showing my weight until I was in my 30s. So when dinner came and I'm eating, oh, I think I only ate two meals. I would eat three full adult meals. That's where I got my pats on the back. My dad was a fabulous cook. I mean, he had worked in restaurants, and my mom, not so much. And anyway, they wanted to know where that was. My sister, you know, was going to open her mouth, and I flashed the fork at her. She knew to zip the lip. And I just said, oh, the neighbors. The neighbors. So I think they got one bite. But anyway, that's been the story of my whole life. I started babysitting for other people at the age of 9. I ate rows of whatever. And it wasn't until I was in program for a few years that I thought, oh, now I know why I would go there after a few times and there would be no food there. They already knew I was, you know, mowing through whatever. So I felt shame about it. I didn't know what it was, but I knew my eating wasn't normal. I could eat a lot. I got a lot of kudos for eating a lot. And even when I went to family events, I could out-eat, you know, the big boy cousins and, you know, go through all of that. When I was 14, I got a job at a bakery. I washed pots and pans and consumed my weight in gold every day that I worked. And then I worked at another one, and then I frosted them at night. I worked the nights. So instead of dating boys, I dated other elements. And because I worked with all of them, I knew which ones wouldn't be missed. And I'd probably go through 2 to 3 dozen a night. And then I started my first diet at that time because a relative told me that my ass was 4X handles wide. And that's pretty amazing because an X handle is about 3 feet. So 12 feet. You know. But you never know. You never know. So I went my first diet, and of course my diet was, let's just start. And I got some relief because I stayed away from the sugar. Sugar is just my first mainline prep. Now, I can eat anything else if it's not nailed down. You know, I'll go for it. I do have some things. I won't pick things off the floor. But, you know, that kind of is a very small microcosm. So I did all that. And then I worked at another food place and ate and ate and ate. And then they went on vacation for a long vacation, and I didn't get hired back. I wonder why. So at that point, I knew I needed to get another job, and I had an uncle who was an ear, nose, and throat doctor, and he was going to get me at the cafeteria at the hospital. And I told my dad, I'm not going to take it. And I remember we had a bit of an argument then, because he's like, you'd make more money, it would help her save for college, blah, blah, blah. I knew that I would get caught with food, and I would get fired, and I would embarrass my family. So instead, I worked with old people because people didn't live to be old in my family. My family is a generations of addicts. You name it, we got it. And I knew that, I needed to do something different. So, and people usually live to be about mid-40s. And so I was afraid of old people. They were scary. And I had the wonderful opportunity to really see people just being people, whether they're 70, 90, 60, if they've had a stroke, they got in a horrible motorcycle accident or whatever. I really learned about people. And then I read in a magazine that was typical for teenage girls at that time, the first time a young girl wrote about anorexia. And I thought, I kind of got it. You know, because I did the starving thing. And the over-exercising. Oh, yeah. I mean, we're going to over-exercise and all of that. But it was anorexia. And I didn't do it the way this young lady did. But it stood in my mind. So then at the end of high school and the beginning of all through college, I went to another 12-step group. Well, I should back up. My parents decided to get sober for a while, and I got introduced to a 12-step program. So we went to a couple family nights, and what I learned from that was one was too many, yet a million was not enough. And that stuck with me for some reason. And as they struggled with their addiction, I struggled with mine, but I went through my program in college and did the diet things. That's all I knew to do. And it wasn't until I was in my second year of teaching, April 1st, 1985, no fluin, I went to OA for the first time. And I had to wait. It was a Monday night, I remember, and I had read about it in an advice column. And I understood 12-step programs, but I didn't know there was one for food. But I remember the night before, I ate a half-sized cereal bowl of brown sugar. It still makes my teeth go, ooh. That's all I had in the house. And I just somehow knew I was going to have to give up sugar. And I remember when I went to that meeting the first night, there was probably about 50 or 60 people there. And they just said that you just can't do sugar. It needs to be fifth or more on the list of ingredients and no white flour and whatever else. And that we just can't do that. And I got it. So I worked on being abstinent. I remember I had a break in abstinence the first year because I didn't know how to deal with life. And I remember I was eating some stuff in the car, driving down a freeway, sobbing. And then I thought, what am I doing? And I remember flinging them out onto the freeway. And then when I looked the other day, they were gone. So, I knew there'd probably be a different way to handle that. But then I got abstinent again, and it was great. I really grooved on it. The couple of things, sponsorship wasn't really strong in my area. We would kind of co-sponsor each other, and we didn't really know what we were doing. And then I dated a man. He was very exotic. He was Greek. He was 23 years older than me, and I'm sure this was going to be it. So we got along really well at first, and then he didn't understand my eating routine. He was a dairy farmer. I mean, the list goes on. And so he would eat very Greek things, lots of oil, all those things. But he was climbing up and down silos all day long. I was sitting at a desk job. Oh, by this time, I had left teaching and was in corporate America. So I was struggling because of the people pleasing. And I was, allowing myself to be pulled away from my my OA family. And so I had some sugar-free chocolate one night, and I was off to the races. I was already falling down the slope. And I know when I hear people say, gosh, I don't know how it happened, it just happened. It always seems that way. I thought it just happened to me, too. But I was already struggling. I was going to relapse meetings. I didn't know what a sponsor was. And I was so focused on pleasing someone else instead of really relying on the answers in this program. So whether good or bad, I was with him for 2 years while I was in the food. And that was hard for him and hard for me. And we went our separate ways, and I'm glad. We weren't a match. We just weren't a match. That I learned afterwards. But after probably about 4 years of abstinence, I was in full relapse. And I was in relapse for 14 years. And when I first walked into OA, I was 155. You'll see in pictures there. And then I got down to 120. And I was very obsessed about that. I was lifting weights. I was going to become the next Ms. Minnesota. And I was going to be so buff. I was bench pressing 135, going for the big 200. I was squatting 175. I was going for 410. And I was doing all this. I was eating healthy, and I wasn't eating enough fat when I look at that then. But I would eat, half birds, just vegetables, all that stuff, and so on. And yet, I would feel hungry. And I would feel hungry because there's more than just physical recovery in these rooms. And, I know for me, I need all three in order to work this program. So I was super obsessed. So I was working out about 25 to 30 hours a week. I was working out 6 days a week. I had my whole routine. I remember I worked out with these two guys. They were hilarious. I mean, I really wish they were around now because I'd be like, I need a little help now. And did that, but then I walked with a fellow teacher, so we would walk 5 mornings a week, and then I would jump rope. I tried to do aerobics, but aerobics just doesn't blend well with me. It makes me want to cry. I mean, I don't know if it's jumping up and down, and not cry like this is hard, but it dislodges something in me. So I tried to stay away from that. But as a result of getting so thin and lean, okay, and it was all about, you know, body fat content, I stopped getting my period. Now for about 6 months. You know, I have to say that was nice. But not really helping. Not really helping. So, you know, and people were saying to me, we think you're obsessed. And I'd be like, I'm not obsessed. As I said, unobsessively. But I was. And so then I, you know, flowed through more, talked to more people, you know, worked my program. As best I could. No, I worked it rather than live it. I live my program now. I work some things a little bit, but this is incorporated. So anyway, I left the relationship and went into a spiral of 14 years of health, really. I got up to 260, that I know is my highest. I underemployed myself. So I went to school to be a teacher, left teaching, corporate America, and all of this, but I just was so disgusted with myself. I hated myself, and I was angry. In my family, it was okay to be angry. It was not okay to be sad. And if you were sad, you were belittled and laughed at and all of that razzmatazz. And so, here's Large Marge storming through life. And it's funny. I know many of us in this room, we get large, we're invisible, but yet we're large. And yet I look at the fat phobia and the prejudice that's out there of, you know, we all should be a certain way. And I look in here and I hear people say we're all shapes and sizes. Well, I think we're all human shapes. I don't see anyone here who looks like a starfish or an octopus. But we all come from all walks of life. And some of us are going to be tall and lifelike and thin, and some of us are going to be more stocky, and some of us are going to be curvy and all of those things. And I'm just here to say, you know, I'm here. I'm about 140 right now. After holding on to 120 pounds for a long time, I've got, you know, extra here. That's, you know, gravity. Really? And wings. And, you know, all of that. And there's times, you know, my ego gets all caught up in that and so on. But the other thing is, it's like, my gosh, I'm not taking a dirt nap. You know, I'm still here. And I'm still working it. And the thing is, it's working this program. I mean, as I'll talk about, like, what are my beliefs? And again, take what you want and leave what doesn't work for you. Is that we all work our own program here. And we find a recovery buddy to work with, or 2, or 10, or 50, or whatever. And we get to where we're going. Because we all come into these rooms, yes, food brings us in a lot of times. We can't stop and so on. But there's a lot of other things that bring us in these rooms too. It's called trauma. It's called shame. It's called disgust. It's called, I feel horrid about myself. I'm a waste of skin. I don't deserve to be here. I'm never going to amount to anything. That's who we are when we come in this room. And you know what? We still sometimes have some of that. It might last a day, it might last a month, it might last 5 minutes, it might last on an interaction we have that day. But the thing is, we're all here to heal. And we're all here to work with our recovery buddies because we don't do this alone. And that's one thing I've really learned in this program. Really, really getting is that we're not perfect. And, oh, intellectually, I can think, yeah, I get it. But then, intellectually, it's kind of like, well, yeah, it's okay if you're imperfect. I'm just fine. Or I don't want people to see me act imperfectly. Because then I'm just human. And when I do things and I call people and say, wow, I was a real putz today. And then someone will say, well, congratulations for being human. And the thing is, with anything we do in our lives, there's a step for that. There is a step for that. We can make amends. We can talk to someone else. We can talk to our higher power, whatever that is, and be relieved of those things. Reach out to someone else. When I'm having a crummy day and I'm all in my head, I think, wow, now I have a mittful of names of people I can call and say, hey, how are you doing? I don't want to talk about me. I want to hear about you. And we know how to do all that. So what did I learn in relapse? I learned that my body doesn't do well with the extra weight. My knees were really giving me a lot of pain. I felt like I was going to pull banister out of cement walls. Surprised I didn't. I had a horrid acid reflux. I would wake up in the middle of the night where I couldn't even breathe. And then I'd have to sit sleeping up for the rest of the night. And then I'd suck on sugar antacids. You know, am I going to do this flavor or that flavor? I mean, it's so insane. Not thinking that. You know, we are here today after millennia of people, right? And those that ate poison die. We'll eat something, and it tastes like poison. And we'll be like, well, maybe if I put salt on it, it might taste a little different. When I had that sugar-free stuff, then I went in for the favorite, you know, candy bar. Took a bite in it, and it was like the most disgusting thing I had ever taken. And then it was like, I'm already all in. Maybe that second bite will be different. And then that took me into 14 years of trying. And I tried the whole thing. I'll do the different food groups. You know, I'll give up dairy. I did give up sugar. I gave up the liquid gold sugar. And, and I haven't had that since 1997. But the thing is, there's a lot of other food to eat out there. And I guess one thing, too, that I have found that has helped me is that I educate myself about the food industry. There's a lot of knowledge out there. I know it's not OA approved. I'm not going to bring up any specific names or so on because, you know, this is OA. But the thing is, we have wisdom and understanding in all of the literature we have. I'm going to be reading through some of it this weekend. But things are changing. We see people in our lives changing. We are changing. And what we're doing with that. So I look at that. And so for this weekend, I want you to think about, we're going into emergence and release. So who do you want to become as a result of this weekend? What is something that you want to have to take away? And tomorrow, I just want you to think about it overnight. I'm going to hand out some cards tomorrow. And then in order for that part of you to emerge, what are you going to release? So where you are today. So emergence. Who do you want to walk into more as a result of this weekend? I mean, I know there's other things in your life, but we're just doing this weekend. And then what do you need to release so that you can emerge to be that person? And I'm not saying that you have to make that release. We all know this is about spiritual recovery. So when I crawled back to OA, well, I should say I started dieting. I quit smoking in 2004, January. I don't know, it was probably like my seventh or eighth time. There was a time I quit for 8.5 years. But once an addict, always an addict. And back at it again. So I did that in January of 2004. But I was praying about it. And I was looking at doing another pay and weigh. Oh, I did a few pay and weighs, by the way, too. And I did all the fancy fad diets out there. I don't know if you've ever heard of the cabbage soup diet. So I made like a week and a half's worth. I ate it in a day and a half. It was so good. I eat as a vegan now. So, I mean, seriously, that wasn't a big deal. So anyway, where was I going here? Anyway, I did all of that, and when I came back, there was a woman at work, and she was a large woman, and always very frenetic, very, very frenetic. And then over a few months, I noticed that she was losing some weight. But more than anything, she was like calm, approachable. So I said, "Hey, Sue, what are you doing? I mean, you look, you know," and oh, I was an executive admin for a chief operating officer. And very angry in that job because I felt I deserved to do more. After all, I had a college degree. But you know what? You know the person who put me in that job? Was me. I applied for it. I got it. That's amazing. It's amazing. So anyway, I asked her, and she goes, "Well, you know," she goes, "I go to this thing, it's called Overeaters Anonymous." "Oh yeah, I know that. Been there, done that. Meg, it's really great. You should come back." Nope, not interested. Been there, done that. So some time goes by, and she comes up again, because I was kind of like Grand Central Station. She's like, Meg, how's it going? "Mom," she goes, "seriously, why don't you come with me Sunday night? I'll be there, you can sit by me," and whatever. Nope, I got it. Not interested. And meanwhile, I'm still looking at a pay and weight, knowing it's not going to do anything. So a third time she comes up, and I said, "Good God, you act like you're working on commission." But it was enough. See, you know, my higher power, I mean, seriously, work. So I finally walked back in on June 14th, 2004, defensive as all get out. I walked in, oh, hi, everyone, friendly. Hi. And I've been to OA before. And they said, "Welcome back." I mean, I had spikes out of my head, you know, talons, a beak. And they were still like one puddle. So that second week, I went back. You know, I had to give up reruns of Murphy Brown. And I remember there was a woman who spoke on step 9, and I thought, I need to do this program differently this time. I do not have it together. I don't have it together. I really need help. So I jumped her after the meeting and just asked her if she'd be my sponsor, and she said yes on the spot. Thank God. And so we worked together, and I remember the first time we were working together, and we were talking, and I was complaining about someone. So there was a woman at work who wanted me to act like her father. She was going to get married, and she wanted me to speak on her behalf because her father was in India, and he couldn't make it to the States. And I didn't want to because I didn't know her very well. It's not like we were close friends. And again, it was the same job, right? So it's like I knew everybody, and so everybody thought, "Well, I'm their friend." I wasn't Mr. Rogers, believe me. And so anyway, I kept saying no and no and no. So I'm complaining about this to my sponsor. And she said, "You know what, Meg? You know what I think the problem is here?" I'm like, "Yes." I said, "She doesn't respect my no." And she said, "You know what? You don't either." So then I punched her in the trachea. And then we were good. But I really had to stop. And I thought, no, because I kept explaining myself instead of saying no and cutting it. Because I want people to like me. It cost me 14 years of relapse because I wanted people to like me. And they didn't. When I was in the food, I worked for a very main hair person who had two little dogs, and I worked there for a while at my largesse. And I remember I was leaving the main office the same time he was, and I remember he looked at me, and he walked ahead and let the door slam in my face. I've had that happen more than once. I've had men walk past me and yell "pig" and hack at my feet. I've had people look at me with disgust. But I'm going to tell you this. This is one thing I've done for everybody. So I went to yoga. It's one of my things. Yoga's going to do it, right? So I took Iyengar, which is very rigorous, and you have to hold your pose, and you stand in your hands, and stand on your head, and all those things. So there was a part that we could at least do it up against the wall. So I'm going to do, it was a headstand, thank goodness. So I had my head in a pillow or whatever, and I couldn't get my largesse up against the wall. And part of me, I was kind of afraid. What if I go through? You know, Wile E. Coyote, you know, went through a lot of things, and he was a lot thinner than I was. So anyway, the teacher disgustedly goes over and grabs my ankle like I'm a side of beef and flips me up on the wall. And, of course, I farted so loud, I'm surprised. Serves him right. I'm so surprised that the cinder blocks did not cascade down. So that was my first thing, and I think he dashed away. I mean, I was so embarrassed that I didn't know what to do. I think the guy just stood there for a while and burgered. And then another time I went to that same class, but there was a sub there, and excuse me, for women, when they have their period, you can't do inverted poses. So there would be a bench, and I had my arms, you know, strapped behind me, and I'm laying on the bench, and then my head's down on the ground so that your half body's on the bench. So I do all this, right? And the whole bench goes up with me. Well, I'm from a family, too, though. We laugh at all this stuff because, I mean, I was embarrassed, number one, but it's funny. So the chick who's doing everything comes charging back, and she's like, "You're disgusting." And here she needed to put sandbags on there because, you know, 260 pounds is going to flip a bench. I mean, seriously. So that's not the kind of benching I want to do ever again. But, and then the third time I went to this class, I remember asking, you know, the Willowites, you know, what were they doing and all this, and they said, "Well, we are rigorous about our practice." And then another time I was going to help because the main Indian guru was going to come and we were going to plan for all of this. And I remember I walked into the meeting. Okay, I had been smoking at this time. This is pre-recovery again. And he just looked at me with disgust. And I felt so ashamed. So this was all building up to coming back into these rooms. So, you know, we all have those experiences. So I come back into the rooms. I decided to really fully surrender. I know what it's like to put the food down, and I worked on a food plan. I knew that sugar was my crack. That goes. And then it was 3 meals a day. And then I put in a snack because I'd eat at 5 in the morning, wouldn't eat till noon. It was too long for me at that time. And then I just worked on moderation and really worked through my steps. And with that sponsor who told me I did not respect my no, I listened to her and worked on my recovery. And I was able to be with her for a couple of years, and unfortunately she went back out on food. She's been in and out, she's back in again. So I'm just thrilled. And we are friends. So it's like, it's okay. I remember at the beginning of OA too, people would say, "Oh, you're going to be, you know, like, you're going to have lots of OA friends." And I thought, I'm not going to be an OA groupie. I would say 95% of my friends are in recovery. Because you get me. I can start in the middle of the story. I know that I could call any one of you and say, "Oh my gosh, this is going on," and you would be like, you would ask questions, we would be kind and loving and all of those things. So I'm really glad for that. So as I started my recovery, I know that, you know, some of you have heard of love languages. My love language is quality time. So if I get quality time with a sponsor, I'm going to listen. I'm going to feel loved. And my other one is acts of service. And what I'm going to say is being a recovery buddy. Because sometimes service has that, I want service. And yet, we're self-supporting. The only way that this retreat could happen is because we have volunteers to do this. And I know some people think, well, if I do this, I have to do something for the rest of my life. And it's like, you can do a one-off, you can do something that lasts a year, you know, whatever. There's all different kinds of things, and it's just getting in there and doing it. So I was going to school then at the time, so I didn't really have the time to do this, sort of working full-time and trying to do my program. So in the middle of that, I went to my doctor, and so I was at 260, and I was probably about 180, and I thought, oh, that's all I'm going to be is 180, 170, because I'm 50 years old, and that's just how it's going to be. Isn't that amazing? I was thinking, thank God, at that moment. Well, that didn't last very long. So anyway, I go, and I'm eating clean. I'm eating clean, and my doctor says, well, you have cholesterol of 230. And I thought, well, that's weird. The only time it's ever been that high is when I've been in, you know, my junk food. And she's like, well, we better look at putting you on medication. And I thought, no way, no way. So I decided to go to a nutritionist. Go figure. I'd been in program 2.5 years. And anyway, I thought, well, I hope I learned something. So she looks at my list, and I had to fill out 6 pages, and she's asking all these questions. And one, she comes in, and she goes like this. She's trying very hard to be professional. And she goes, oh, is this really how much Diet Cola you drink a day? I put 18 cans. I didn't tell her, well, on the weekends it was more. And I also didn't tell her about the 4 quarts of the adult Kool-Aid. That's that, you know, the artificial sweetener in it that I would drink. I make 4 quarts into 2 quarts of water because it's got to be that taste. And, oh, and then the gum. You know, so, you know, sugar-free is okay. So then I kind of mentioned that a bit. And she said, that's killing your liver. And I looked at her and she said, you might want to think about letting that one go. And she knew about OA. She wasn't an OA person, but she knew about OA. That's why I went to her. And then I also found out I couldn't digest wheat very well. I just got really bloated, and it was painful. And it was like that every day for my whole life. But I said to her, very calmly and sweetly, well, don't expect me to do this tomorrow. And she's like, no, Meg, whatever you want to do. So I gave it a couple weeks to just kind of ease into it, you know, eat the foods that I had and so on. And boy, giving up that wheat after a week, it was like, wow, I don't have that bloated feeling anymore. Who knew? And the thing is, I have a lot of digestive stuff in my family. Colons removed, colon resections, all of this. So, I mean, plus I was colicky as a baby. So, the night before the year, I'm going to get my cholesterol tested again. If there was ever a question, was I an alcoholic? Was I a food addict? I thought, if my cholesterol doesn't go down significantly, I'm going to pick up my Diet Cola. So I go and I get my test back. It went from 230 to 162. That was even lower. I mean, I didn't even have a number in my head. But that was a good number. That was a very good number. So I stayed with that because I really want to recover. I don't want to go back to the way it was. My journey continued. So a friend of mine said, you're going to go be an intergroup rep. You're going to have to sub for me because I can't make it all the time and you need to do more. Okay, fine. Well, I went. I was shy. Okay, extremely extroverted, but I can also be extremely shy. For about 10 minutes, and then what I do is I try to be funny so that nobody knows that I'm shy. And I started meeting some people, and then my higher power said to me in January of 2010, Meg, you are going to go to intergroup and you are going to put your name in for treasurer. Because I've been a treasurer of other non-profit organizations, so I knew how to do that. So I did. I drove the intergroup meeting. We got in there. I was so freaked out. I was so sure there was going to be at least 4 or 5 people that were going to raise their hands. Yeah. I know. It's what you don't know, what you don't know. I went in there, raised my hand, and right away when they said, you know, we're taking names, and I said, I would like to run for treasurer. And then it was silent, and then everybody started laughing. And the woman who was taking the name, she was the vice chair at the time, and she said, wow. She said, I'm coming to intergroup now for about, I don't know, 10 or 15 years. She said, we usually have to beg someone to be treasurer, and you just came in. I don't know who you are. I mean, I know you've been here a few times, and you want to be treasurer. Does anybody else want to? No one else. She goes, okay, done. And I voted on it, and whatever. So I became treasurer. And then that led to, I mean, just talking about what I did, because this is my call. I love to be with people and power and all that. And then I became chair for a couple of years. And a couple of years in the program, so, you know, 2006, you know, the whole, you know, sugar-free business and whatever, and I was saying to God, you know, I don't need to be going to all these meetings. And God showed me my life as it was in those 14 years. I was going to one meeting a week. Okay, now you can go to 7 meetings, you know, you can go 24/7. You can go to the UK, you can go to Australia, you can go to Russia. But I was going to one meeting a week, and it was like, oh, I don't know. 10-minute drive, and so it was a hardship. So when 2011 came along and I became chair, and Intergroup was just kind of in that lull period, and I thought, what are we going to do here? And Higher Power said, you know what, Meg? I'd like you to visit all the groups in your Intergroup. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. There's 70 meetings. I work for a living. Oh, yeah, I know that. Well, some of those meetings are during the day. And in case you didn't know, I work during the day. Yep, I know. Well, it's going to be a lot of driving. There's some meetings that are 3 hours away, one way. And I'm going to drive that? What about gas money? Yep, got it covered. So whenever I argue, if I think it's a grandiose idea, and I get all excited about it and whatever, it's a grandiose idea. When I start arguing and negotiating and bargaining, it's like, okay. I went to 69, because one was my meeting. I went to 69 meetings in 7 months. I had it all charted out. I was a contract employee, so when I didn't work, I didn't get paid. So it wasn't like I was cheating anyone. There was one in La Crosse, Wisconsin. It was 3 hours away. I got off work at 3:45 that day, put in 15 minutes early, took 3 hours to get down there, went to their meeting, drove 3 hours back. It was perfect. Still made it to work the next day. And so I did that, and I was a newcomer 69 times. And some people are like, wow, you're in Intergroup, please. No. But I saw a lot. I met a lot of people, and then I invited people, please come to Intergroup. Please come to Intergroup. And they did. And then because I was a teacher, I did a thing because we have to make it fun. I got a bunch of dollar store prizes. And then I had a contest every month. Do you know your OA? And I had 10 questions. So the first month was all about region. So we're region 4. So I put, what states are part of region 4? How many regions are in the world? Always 10 questions. Always 10 questions. So I gave them like 5 minutes. It was like a time, and then see who'd win. And people at first were like, and then they did it, and then I'd say, okay, go to the back table and get your prize. The next month, people were coming early because they wanted to scope out the prizes. Go from there. So it worked, but I also got a chance to educate them on OA because the next month was about OA at large. And then the next one was about the literature, and the next, and so on and so forth. And then at the end, I could put on there how many miles did I travel, to visit all the meetings? How many meetings did I go to? How many states did I visit? All of those things. So that was really fun. And in Minnesota, at that time too, we have the HAL format, which is a beautiful format, and we have traditional format, and I think OA in Action was coming. But there was animosity. It's us and them, us and them. I don't know about you, but OA is OA. And however you practice your program is your business and how you do it. And I'd heard, those OA house, they're Nazis. It's like, really? I've never seen anyone skinned alive or, all of a sudden disappeared for the rest of their life. They usually came out thinner and happier. It's amazing. And I went to my first meeting at a convention, a Minnesota State Convention, and I was so invigorated. It was so lively and lovely. And so I went to HAL meetings and traditional meetings and all of this. And so I brought it out into the open, into OA, and I said, if you've not been to a HAL meeting, I encourage you to go to one. And if you've not been to a traditional meeting, I encourage you to go to one. There's benefits and beauty in both. And that's how I feel this program is. We all matter. We all count. We all deserve to recover, and we all deserve to recover the way that works for us. And that's why there's more than one way. And I work the program very differently than I did when I was first in here back in 85, and also that differently than in 2004. I'm a different person. Thank goodness. That means I've incorporated this living into my life. I don't look at, oh my gosh, I have to read chapter 2. There are times when people will say, well, have you consulted your higher power on this? And then I'll say, who? Because I forget. But I also know I can't do this alone, and I'm so grateful that I don't do this alone. So There's a few things that I work, that I walk away with, that I have, is that I'm 100% responsible for my abstinence. When I work with new people and they say, oh, I went to a graduation party and all they had was graduation food. Well, we know what that is. And I said, oh, well, what was your plan B? And we talk about plan B, all the things you can keep in your car, all the stuff that doesn't rot over a period of time. What are your backups? I brought some backups with me because I eat as a vegan. And sometimes there may be enough of vegetables for me, and sometimes there isn't. It's nothing on anyone else. I'm just responsible for that. And to find substitutes. And that every meal is not going to be a 10. You know, there's going to be some meals that just stink. They're just, meh, and whatever. But I also believe it's okay to eat what you really love in recovery. I mean, yeah, I didn't really love that stuff. I thought I did, but again, it tasted like poison, and it poisoned me. But those are the things that are responsible, and that I'm also responsible for participating in this program. I know that we talk about this being a disease of isolation, and COVID has really turned things on its ear. And I know we're just regaining ourselves. How many of you are meeting face-to-face? Some of you are. Okay. We went face-to-face in Minnesota, our one meeting, June of last year. And we had some people who were just new to OA, just through online video. And so they came that first night, and of course, us extroverts were like bouncing off the walls. And I was like, Tom, how's it going? You glad you're here? And he's like, you're pretty lively. He's still coming after a year. So it's good. But we do hybrid. And we struggled with that at first. And if you want to ask me later, we have a meeting device that helps with the hybrid situation that makes it more user-friendly. But it really helps. And I just find for me it's wonderful being face-to-face with people because then I can see their eyes and see what's going on and all of that. So it's really important to me. The other thing that I really think is important is that we do need to connect. And I'm just going to pull something from a lifeline. This is from May, June of 2017. Connection questions. I'm blessed with over 12 years of abstinence after a horrific relapse. What did I do differently? I became more honest, willing, and open with my fellows and my sponsor. No longer do I try to look like I have it all together when I don't, because that way of thinking leads me right back into the food. I know this from experience. Since it's my second time in recovery, I want it to last until I die. Another thing I do now is pick up the phone and call people. So I don't have to worry anymore about, oh, I can't call anybody, I'm going to bug them. It's kind of like, oh, I've got about six people I can bug right now. Who's going to be available? And there was a time, and there's times if I need something, I'll just say, hey, do you have 5 minutes? Do you have 10? There was a time I was in such huge rust, and I was driving down to Iowa to visit my dad, and I mean, it was just tough. And I knew six people I could call. I was on person number four. And I just said, do you have at least an hour? I am so upset right now. I need someone to help talk me off the edge. And we were on the phone for, I would say, an hour and a half to 2 hours. And it was wonderful to talk through everything. And so then by the time I got to see my dad, I was calm and loving. That's how I wanted to be when I saw him. So these are just some questions that can be asked when we pick up that, you know, I hear people say the two-ton phone, and it's like, wow, I had no problem picking up that phone asking for takeout. I had no problem picking up the phone to talk smack about a colleague. But man, if I want to talk to someone in recovery, then all of a sudden I get kind of shy and timid because I might be vulnerable. It's like, yeah, guess what? We all are. That's the beauty. That's what they say. It's weakness that brings us together. And it doesn't mean we have to live in that. It just means we all get it. If we were all perfect, we'd all be like
why are we here? You know, and plus, I don't know about you guys, but when I hear people's stories, I'm like, dang, I didn't know that about that person. And there was a person I met in recovery, and she said one day, her husband said, yeah, one day she came home, and she was, like, weird for about 2 weeks, and then it was like, I don't even know who this woman is. She said one day she decided to give up food and drugs the same day. And they were still married. The story was 7 years after the fact. But she's the type of person that she talked about when she played softball as a girl in grade school. She had long hair, and she and her friend would be out in the outfield, and all they do is brush their hair. So she did not look like a druggie. Food I can get, but that's what she did. So that's what I love. But here are some questions we can ask. How is your day going? What do you like about your food plan? Do you weigh and measure your food? Are there foods you eat now that you were sure you'd hate but really enjoy? When and how do you meditate? Do you listen to music? Do you sit up or lie down? How do you handle reducing your desire to gossip? How have your family relationships changed since you've been in program and abstinent? I'm beginning to lose weight that people notice. It's kind of nice that now people are giving me advice about what to eat and how quickly or slowly I should lose. How did you handle that? You know, and, you know, there's all kinds of things. You have a nutritionist or a dietitian you could recommend. I'm not very creative with food preparation. Do you have ideas about recipes? Okay, we all love to talk about recipes. We all love to talk about our food. So I ate a traditional, you know, American diet, meat, potatoes, vegetables, or whatever, or just say a good Irish diet. And it was about 10 years ago, and I was having problems with my digestion or whatever, and decided to give up dairy because I was eating, you know, the fat-free yogurt. And I'd eat 8 cups of vegetables a day. I'd eat 8 cups of raw cabbage and drink a gallon of water, and I'd still have problems. As soon as I gave up dairy, it went away. But I was still holding extra weight. And I was looking, because I went to World, I roomed with 2 tall people. Those people, you know? And they weighed and measured their food. I wasn't really, you know, I mean, I weighed some stuff then. I don't know, I did, but I was eating differently. And I saw what their measurement of nuts was compared to mine. And even though I was doing what my nutritionist said, you know, mine looked like a big oat bag, you know, that you just strap around your head. And, you know, and they had like, you know, these 2 little delicate things. You know, and they lick them, sniff them, you know, to make it last, you know, 12 seconds instead of 10. But anyway, I, you know, talked to them about all of this. And I thought, maybe I need to make some adjustments. So I did. And I thought, well, maybe I'll lose, you know, 5 to 10 pounds or whatever. I lost 50. So that's where, going back to when I thought I was God and thought, you know, I'm at this weight. So I got down to about 130. And it's interesting. So I was abstinent, doing service and all this, and it was amazing how many people were telling me I was too thin. So many people were telling me I was eating the wrong things. And all of this. And that was a new learning curve. So my whole thing is we come into these rooms for weight, our food. I had to learn how to live life without leaning on food. So I had to learn with, deal with people who were critical of me. I had to learn how to find the words. The only way I could learn how to find the words, read our literature, but talk to you. Hey, what do you do when someone says this to you? Hey, have you ever had this happen? And so on. So some of my challenges I had, I was, 3 years in, and I was working as a project manager at a company, and I was new to the role, and I also made more money. Okay, so this is after I stopped underemploying myself, got a job, and I made almost $25,000 more than I was making the year before. That was really wild. I felt I didn't deserve that, but I wasn't going to say no. And I really did have the skills, but I didn't have the self-confidence. So I worked my way through, and yet the teams I worked with all enjoyed me. But it was the people who, it's those critical people who disapprove of me that I want their approval. even though the people who enjoy me and love me and are there for me, I'll put their stuff on the back burner. It's like, well, yeah, they'd say that just because they're my friends. Well, yeah, that's what we say about our friends. So I had my boss, director, and VP of IT holding me for a year. I came home every night. I made OA phone calls every night, and my sister was one of them. I cried every single night. I was terrified. I thought I was going to lose my job and then, of course, become a banker. Because this is the only job I was ever going to have, because that's what I was told. You're not doing anything, you're not doing it right, you're doing it wrong, blah, 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 and just push, 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 push. Plus, I was going to school, plus working full-time, so yes, I did not have time to do OA service at that time. But the one thing I did not do this time, I did not choose food. I lived through that horrid, wrenching pain. And when it came time for me to quit, I had nothing else waiting for me out there. I really thought, am I going to have to go back to the way I was and all this? I mean, whatever, but I hung on to my friends. And I remember one friend, she was my former sponsor at the time, and we had come back and said, you know, Meg, you have to look at your part in this. I wanted to punch more than a trachea. It took me several years after that to look at my part because I thought, I don't deserve this. Nobody deserves this. I did my master's thesis on bullying in the workplace, and this is what I learned. Men and women are bullied equally. Or no, men and women bully equally. Women are bullied more. But the type of people who are bullied are well-liked, very intelligent, get along with a lot of people, very creative, focus on solution, blah, 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 blah. So I needed to do that for part of my healing. But it really took several years after that. What was my part? I made those three women my higher power. Even though I was working my program and whatever, I couldn't get past. I prayed, I journaled, I meditated, I called, I cried, and all those things. All I knew was don't pick up, don't pick up, don't pick up, don't pick up. And I left, and I landed another job, and, you know, life went on and all of that. But that was one of those challenges, and it was one of those life lessons that I got to learn. You don't want to have to repeat. Yeah, it won't repeat again. I'm a different person as a result of that. And if I see it coming on, I know what to say now. And I know how to handle myself and so on. But also as a result of staying in these rooms year after year and doing what I need to do and facing myself over and over again, I become a calmer person, a kinder person. And it's like now I can say, I love my boss, I love my coworkers, I have a beautiful home, I have food to eat, healthy food, I have money in the bank, I have money in the bank for when I retire, I have beautiful, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful friends. And before, it was like, if so-and-so would just be different, if so-and-so would just be different, and so-and-so is a this and a that and whatever else. And it's like, I'm hanging around nicer people too. I used to try to find the meanest woman because I was going to teach her how to be kind. You know, again, that's like eating poison. You know, well, okay, this one didn't work so well. I'll try another one. So, meanwhile, I just want to say this part of my story. My dad and mom found recovery in 1991. My mom died 6 months later. My dad stayed sober all those years, even while I was in the food. And we drove down to Alpine, Texas to visit a brother. I got 22 hours to and from with him talking. I'm still in the food, right, a little bit before. But then I got into recovery, and we had to work on really mending our friendship because it was a very volatile childhood. But we're going to work, again, thing in program. We really are forgiving people when we give it a chance, when we give ourselves a chance. And I'm not saying you have to forgive and forget. I could do a whole workshop on all forgiving. But my dad was doing his part. Big difference. Meg was doing her part. So flash forward to, 2009. My dad turned 80. I made amends to him, formal amends to him. I didn't plan on doing that on his 80th birthday, but I happened to be there at the time, whatever. My brother was there. I said to my brother, hey, I got to make amends to Dad. You know, do you mind? And he just didn't take that morning. So we drove down to the War Memorial in Dubuque, Iowa, sat in the car because it was raining cold. I read my amends to him. And after I ran it through a fellow and so on, so that it wasn't, you know, grandiose or whatever, I needed to really be honest and vulnerable. So we had a lovely talk and so on, and continued to heal and work through all this. Flash forward of February of 17. And one of my aunts had died, and I have four siblings, I'm the oldest of five. We all drove or flew in, and we went to the wake. And then my dad said, so he had 26 years under his belt, and he said, all right, guys, are you done now? Because we're going to go in the front room now, and I'm going to make amends to you. So we got together, and for 2 hours, we cried and talked and laughed. He had kept letters when he first got sober. He asked us to write him letters, how his drinking affected our life. And I wrote that in 1991. I was newly out of recovery. I was angry. But my main message was, I don't think you know who I am. That hurts. He had kept another sibling's letter. He read those out loud. He asked us one and one, is there anything I can apologize for? That is an uber miracle. He got recovery at 61. He died 6 months later, almost in his 27th year. I am 63. I want to carry his legacy. I want to be there for you. I don't want to walk away again and be all alone. I don't want to miss the miracle. And even if you're in these rooms and you're struggling, stay. You deserve to be here. There's only one qualification, the desire. Who cares if someone's heavier or thinner than you are? Leaner or tauter? Who cares? Nobody. You come here to be who you are called to be. We are here for a reason. We are here to be for a reason. You have your very own reason. I want to be a part of that reason. I want to see that spark and that joy. We know outside these rooms, there's a lot of turmoil going on. We can be swept up in that, or we can be that lightness of life and work within each other to stay united, to work through whatever comes our way. And in this country, we have a lot to learn. There's a lot of healing that needs to be done. And as hard and difficult as it is, in my opinion, I'm glad that we are facing a lot of things, because that's where healing begins. That's what this program asks us to do. We ate to survive. We really did. I did. But I don't need to survive that anymore. My life is not that anymore. My life is here. My life is with you. And so as we go through this weekend, like I said, we're going to do things. I'm going to give you time to have time by yourself, or for small groups, large groups, those kinds of things. But I really want you to think about, what is your spiritual pull? What is it that you would like to help unleash, release? And it doesn't mean that it has to be a bad thing. It can be, what is a release for me? Stop relying on what others think of me, those people who don't matter. I don't want to say don't matter, that they are not an integral, active part of my life. I also want to give away self-doubt that I have in certain things. You know, it doesn't have to be ginormous things, it could be small things, but it can be those things that dog us. But how do you want to emerge? I want to feel more grateful about what I have, because I have a lot. I probably have more than 98% of the people in this world. And am I really thankful about it? Or am I always trying to chase the thing that the world is trying to tell us we don't have enough of? I've got more than enough. And I remember there was a woman who said things for us to be grateful for having more than enough. I have more than enough. And so I thank you for walking this journey with me. And with that, I pass.